Today is Wednesday, June 29th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Ira Melman. I'm in Washington, D.C. Coming your way, Turkey reels from a major attack at its chief international airport.
This will be a major blow to Turkey. It is a major tourism destination, number four in the world for visitors from around the world.
We'll talk with correspondent Dorian Jones in Istanbul about that. Also ahead, what are the next steps for the EU after the Brexit vote? Lisa Bryant's been covering that. She's standing by in Paris. And there are indications Mars at one time had much more oxygen in its atmosphere than it now does. Today on International Edition, Istanbul has fully reopened. Atatürk International Airport, after a suicide attack, killed 41 people and injured more than 200 yesterday. At least 10 of those killed in the attacks were foreigners. 109 of the 239 injured have been released from the hospital. That according to Istanbul's governor. Three suicide bombers reportedly shot several people before detonating explosives at the international arrivals terminal. Joining us from Istanbul is Dorian Jones, who covers Turkey in the Middle East for VOA. Dorian, thanks for being with us. There was no immediate claim of responsibility. However, the Turkish Prime Minister said early evidence points to an attack by Islamic State extremists. He called the attack cowardly and vowed his country will continue to press his fight against extremism. What does this do as far as the image that Turkey would like to have as a safe place to be?
Well, it certainly has delivered a hammer blow to those aspirations. This is just the latest in a series of terror attacks at Istanbul and the capital Ankara have experienced in the last year. This latest attack brings now the death toll to over 250 people have been killed in the space of 12 months in major bombing attacks on Istanbul and the capital Ankara. This will be a major blow to Turkey. It is a major tourism destination, number four in the world for visitors from around the world. This will have all the countries already reeling from a series of attacks on foreign tourists in Istanbul. This year we have seen two suicide attacks, both blamed on Islamic State, targeting foreign tourists. The tourism industry has all but collapsed in many parts of the country. And this, in many ways, is seen as the final death knell in the Turkish tourism industry for this year, at least. Beyond that, it will have also growing effects on the psychology of the country as a whole. There is this growing fears that there appears to be little end in sight to this ongoing systematic campaign of terror attacks by Islamic State and Kurdish rebels of the PKK. They are occurring nearly every month. And this will have major effects on the economy and also on the psychology of people.
What are the contributing factors, as far as you can see it, to this uptick in attacks is concerned? What are the politics as far as involvement of both Islamic State and the Kurdish rebels?
Well, in many ways, Turkey is this vortex of turmoil, both internally and externally. The critics will say that in part this is the responsibility of the government. Well, they say it's failed government policies. The government deny that. But what we have seen is that last July saw a collapse in a nearly three-year peace process with the Kurdish rebel group, the PKK. There, that process was bringing genuine hope that there would be the end of nearly a four-decade conflict that has claimed over 40,000 lives. What we've seen since the collapse in that peace process, which both sides are blaming one another for, is unprecedented levels of violence across Turkey's predominantly Kurdish southeast. Many towns in the Turkey's predominantly Kurdish region, centers of towns and villages have been devastated by fighting, and the Kurdish rebel group are increasingly targeting Turkey's main cities in retaliation to that crackdown. On top of that, we have Islamic State, and in many ways, the fact that the international coalition against Islamic State are appearing to have now scoring increasing victories against the jihadist group, there was this wide expectation that they would start to hit out more. And this, in fact, Turkish media are reporting that Turkish intelligence did give a warning 20 days ago that Istanbul could be the target of a major attack by Islamic State. This has been echoed by foreign intelligence services. They've been growing concerns and warnings that as more successes and defeats are inflicted on Islamic State in both Syria and Iraq. They will be looking for a major attack, and Istanbul Atatürk Airport is seen as a prime target for that. It is very similar to the attack that Islamic State carried out on Brussels' airport and metro station in March.
What is the overall feeling about what is happening in Turkey among the Turkish people?
Well, I mean, I think that there is this across the board, there is this concern that Turkey is in many ways increasingly being sucked into the instability on its southern border. There has been raging civil war in Syria, conflict in Iraq, and there is this growing concern that that instability is starting to spread into Turkey itself. And I think that this has been a major concern for several years. And with this wave of attacks, which do appear to show no end in sight, that those concerns are likely to grow. It is also going to fuel the deep polarization within Turkey. This country is split down the middle between the supporters and opponents of the president. Opponents of the president are accusing this turmoil as a result of failed policies, of turning a blind eye to the Islamic State, the collapse in the peace process, while supporters of the president are saying that this is part of, in many ways, conspiracies and failures of Turkey's allies to support Turkey in what they call this universal war in terror. Either way, these latest attacks will likely fuel the further polarization within Turkey, despite appeals by the Turkish prime minister calls for national unity.
Dorian Jones covers Turkey and the Middle East for VOA. And Dorian, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
You're welcome.
Well, U.S. President Barack Obama has come out with a comment on yesterday's attack at the airport in Istanbul. He's pledging to what he called dismantle organizations of hate after the deadly bombing. He said the gun and bomb attacks that killed 41 people at Atatürk Airport on Tuesday shows how little these vicious organizations have to offer. Turkish officials, as we told you, have blamed the attack on the Islamic State group. Obama also offered his condolences to the Turkish people. He spoke after a one-on-one meeting in Canada with Mexican President Enrique Peña Nieto. Obama also spoke with Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan during the flight to Canada. Well, Andrew Palshevsky, VOA's and International Edition's social media guru, joins us now, as he does on every program. And I take it this is trending somewhat, is that correct?
Absolutely. It's trending across a number of different hashtags. Of course, hashtag Istanbul, but hashtag pray for Istanbul as well, and several in Turkish. So we're seeing a lot of social media interest in this story. As we see, you know, unfortunately, time and time again, when there are these terrorist attacks, we kind of see this pattern play out where you get the initial reports, the death toll. As the death toll rises, you see those updates on social media. And then you learn about some of the stories of heroism. For example, there's this police officer or airport security officer who was able to warn people, and they were able to get away seconds before one of the suicide bombers detonated, and he's being hailed as a hero. He gave his life so he could get people away from there. Now, what's different about this versus other terrorist attacks that we've covered is that this was in a place that has a lot of cameras, security cameras, people with phones. So we're seeing a lot of footage, especially shared on social media, of the moments of the explosions. We're seeing people kind of running away, and then seconds later, the explosion going off. So we're seeing that policeman's heroism play out on video.
Pictures are frightening, horrific.
It is, and that's the reaction we're seeing on social media. All those kinds of words, just jarring, horrific, just really upsetting for a lot of people. But it puts it in a way, it shows people what's going on. It's one thing, I think, for people to read about these numbers and read about the death tolls, but when people see these explosions happen on social media, it puts it in a whole new light.
What else has gone on?
Well, there's this hashtag trending, hashtag heterosexual pride day. Now, this apparently has started on social media as a response to the gay pride parades and gay pride celebrations happening throughout the world over the course of the month of June. And people saying, well, why isn't there a heterosexual pride parade? So this has kicked off a back and forth over whether there should be a heterosexual pride parade, what that means, if it's bigotry, if it's discriminating.
Is it being posed as bigotry?
Well, that's what a lot of people are saying. And there's this one quote that a lot of people are sharing on social media where they say gay pride isn't really celebrating being gay, but celebrating existing without persecution. And it says, so instead of wondering why there isn't a straight pride movement, be thankful you don't need one. So that's being shared all over social media as that debate continues.
How do people get in touch with you? How do they let us know what they're doing on social media?
They can find us at VOA_IE, and they can find me at APAL, APAL. on Twitter.
That's Andrew Palshevsky. He's a pal. Among the top stories in the world, Turkey blames Islamic State jihadists for the deadly assault on Istanbul's Atatürk airport. European Union leaders are focusing on carving out a future without Britain. Toyota recalls more than 3 million vehicles worldwide for faulty airbags and defective emission control units. Expanded coverage of these stories and more on the VOAnews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition, and this is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Measurements made by NASA's Curiosity Mars rover suggests that Mars may have had an Earth-like past, with much more oxygen in its atmosphere than it has now. Researchers who analyzed data from Curiosity's ChemCam, or chemistry and camera instrument, say they have found high levels of manganese oxides in some Martian rocks gathered in Gale Crater, the rover's study area. Nina Lanza from the Los Alamos National Laboratory in New Mexico is the lead author of a study outlining the findings. She says the only ways on Earth that such manganese oxide materials can be made involve either atmospheric oxygen or microbes. Lanza says that the most plausible explanation for the presence of the manganese oxides is that of a much higher level of oxygen in the atmosphere. The Martian atmosphere now is made up of mostly carbon dioxide with only traces of free oxygen. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition. European Union leaders are focusing this day on carving out a future without Britain as they wrap up a summit in Brussels days after Britain's voted to leave that bloc. They have called for Britain to exit quickly, not to expect any membership benefits without paying the price. Joining us from Paris is correspondent Lisa Bryan, who has been covering the story for VOA from Paris. Lisa, why does there seem to be, at least seemingly, a rush to get this done by the EU, even though we hear continuing reports of the possibility of a re-vote in Great Britain?
That's a good question. I think the feeling among EU leaders is that, more uncertainty is not good for anybody. It's not good for the financial markets. It's not good for their own economies and their own public. You know, the EU is not a particularly an issue that many people like. It's not popular among many Europeans. So I think that they want to have certainty and to move forward and also to figure out what to do next in terms of carving out a future without Britain. And all of this can't be done until Britain actually triggers the so-called Article 50 that unleashes sort of the process to exit.
You're in Paris. What is the overall feeling about the situation there and also from what you hear from Brussels and around the rest of Europe?
Well, there are sort of different points of view. On the one hand, yes, there's been plenty of speculation in the press and in some remarks that there could be a revote, that there are options for the British Parliament to basically say no, that there's this potential fallout in terms of Scotland. And in fact, the Scottish leader will be meeting with European Union officials later today. On the one hand, you get a fairly strong response by a number of EU leaders, Jean-Claude Juncker being one of them. He's the president of the European Commission, and he says, out is out. You made the decision, Britain. Now you have to stick by it. When you talk to people on the streets of Paris, which I have done, there's kind of a mixed feeling. Some people are thinking, well, maybe we should have a French Brexit vote, that is, a Frexit vote. Others are saying, listen, this is a real shame, that this kind of hurts the European project, whatever that might be. So there is kind of a real mix of different feelings, from anger to that's the way it is, let's move forward. That would be Angela Merkel, Germany's chancellor, and also a sense of, well, perhaps we should think about the same thing.
So what are the priorities of the EU meetings going on now?
What a lot of people are saying is we need to have a whole overhaul of what the EU is about to move forward. So a real fundamental relook about what this bloc is about, what its goals are, and how it's going to respond to European publics.
Is there fear in the aftermath of the Brexit vote?
Yeah, there is fear. Some people fear that the Brexit vote could spark other votes in the same direction, a Grexit vote in Greece, a Frexit vote in France, where there are elections next year, and the National Front, the far right, is talking about a similar sort of referendum. The fear that it could trigger many other sort of a domino effect. On the other hand, experts are also saying, hey, you know, look at the disarray that's going on already in Britain in every way, financially, politically, et cetera. And actually, you may get the opposite direction, where people are going to want more certainty and stability. And in some ways, that has been echoed in Spain, where they had elections on Sunday. And instead of going for more populist parties, even though there's no firm fallout so far in that vote, that many people still backed the conservative Parti Popular, the PP in Spain, showing that there is a certain search for stability, at least in some areas.
Well, we spoke earlier about the EU president. I noticed, and some other people noticed as well, that Jean-Claude Juncker spoke yesterday only in French and German. In previous sessions, he's used English as well, not yesterday. Some reports are saying there is some effort to eliminate English from the official EU proceedings following the Brexit vote. Can you shed any light on that at all?
Yes, it's actually quite interesting. It's hard to say whether to what extent Juncker is speaking other languages besides English more than he has been. There has been a tendency by certain EU politicians to speak the language of their country. The European Parliament president has a tendency to speak German. You'll get obviously François Hollande, who I'm told does not speak great English anyway, who will speak in French anyway. Yes, there have been calls to use other languages. In France, it's happened by some politicians. Hey, let's use French instead, and let's kick out English. But don't forget, there are also member states that are Anglophone. For example, Ireland being one of them. Malta uses English. Plus, it is the language of some people called it globish. It's the language used across the world. It's a language to do business. What's going to happen in terms of handling discussions with Eastern European member states? So even though there may be sort of a spin-offs and angry reactions that are affecting the language discussions, it's unlikely that anything but English will be the main language in Brussels anytime soon.
Lisa Bryan has been covering the whole Brexit and EU situation from Paris for VOA. Lisa, thanks so much for spending some time with us.
My pleasure.
This is VOA.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
VOA Special English, a way to learn American English and much more. Broadcasting a half hour of world news and features every day on radio. You can also find Special English on television and online at voaspecialenglish.com for 50 years, helping people understand world events and the language and culture of America.
This is International Edition, and a VOA-sponsored panel in Washington yesterday. Four young Muslims spoke of the challenges they face living in this country. More from Slavik Sahuk.
An estimated 3.3 million Muslims live in the United States, about 1% of the total population. That number is expected to double in the next 3 to 4 decades, and by the year 2040, Muslims are projected to become the second largest religious group in the United States. Young Muslims point out that they're not a homogenous group. St. Louis resident Oya Rose Aktas says her mother is an American Christian and her father is a Turkish Muslim.
Oftentimes people try to split it into moderate Muslims and conservative Muslims, but there's a lot of diversity past that. And I think that that's one of the nuances that gets lost in discussions about Islam in the U.S.
Sometimes young Muslims have more than one identity that defines them.
It definitely is a struggle, not only being a Muslim, not only being a Muslim American, being Somali, being black, being young. There's a lot of identities that you have to reconcile. It's not easy, but luckily I was born into it, and this has been a lifelong process for me. Whereas when you immigrate, like my parents, for example, you have to shift and learn to change from being the majority to being a minority.
The panelists complained that crimes perpetrated by Muslims get disproportionately high media coverage.
I feel like whenever a Muslim does something like that, it's all over the media. There's so much attention to it. But if a Westerner does the same thing, I don't think it has the same impact.
Iraqi-born Othman Al-Talib said the ratio of crimes committed by U.S. Muslims is low compared to other groups. He said young people are more likely to get radicalized if they spend most of their time alone before the computer.
So I definitely think the message for us should be, let's get our youth out, bring them to the mosques, bring them to Muslim events and organizations, and let them interact with other people.
The new generation of U.S. Muslims also is frustrated by the widespread talk of Islamic radicalization and wants more focus on encouraging young people to express their hopes and plans for the future. Slarica Hoke, VOA News, Washington.
And that's our program, International Edition. Find us at voanews.com. I'm Ira Millman. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
4 years ago, determined to end preventable child deaths within a generation, the United States, Ethiopia, and India joined UNICEF to rally the world behind the Child Survival Call to Action, a sustained global effort to save the lives of children under the age of 5. The goal was to lower child mortality rates in the hardest-hit countries to 20 deaths per 1,000 live births by the year 2035, and to continue progress in those nations already below that rate. Out of this grew Acting on the Call, Ending Preventable Child and Maternal Deaths, a USAID-led initiative that identified 24 high-priority countries, which together accounted for 70% of all child and maternal deaths, and developed for them results-oriented plans to meet these targets. And as a result, children are surviving at a rate never seen before, while fewer mothers are dying due to complications from pregnancy and childbirth. Since 2008, USAID's efforts in the 24 priority countries have helped save the lives of 4.6 million children and 200,000 women. Last year saw some particularly impressive results. So, for example, newborn deaths dropped by 13% in target facilities in India. 95% of Tanzania's previously unprotected children living in areas where immunization rates have been lowest have been vaccinated. And for the first time ever, all of the Democratic Republic of the Congo received malaria program coverage. And we are hoping to do even better. USAID's drive to end preventable child and maternal deaths focuses on the poorest 40% of the population in priority countries, in hopes of saving the lives of 8 million mothers and children from this segment of the population by 2020. And the program will expand to another priority country, Burma. We've taken a challenge that was once too big to tackle and turned it into a solvable problem, said USAID Administrator Gail Smith. We can measure our progress against achievable targets. We can apply interventions where the evidence tells us they will have the greatest impact. We're building momentum that I'm confident will carry us over the finish line. A world where preventable maternal and child deaths are actually prevented.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.